Welcome to the Water Resources Podcast. I am Bridget Scanlon. In this podcast, we discuss water challenges with leading experts, including topics on extreme climate events, overexploitation, and potential solutions towards more sustainable management. I am pleased to welcome Natalie Voisin to the podcast. Natalie is the Chief Scientist for Regional Climate Energy Dynamics at the Pacific Northwest National Lab, which is a U.S. Department of Energy research center. And today we're going to talk about linkages and interdependencies between water and electricity within the context of droughts and floods and climate extremes, and also evolving infrastructure. Thank you so much, Natalie, for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Bridget. I'm really excited to join your podcast.
So, Natalie, we've known each other for quite a while, and I really admired the work that you do at the interface between water and electricity and of it all sorts of aspects. I think you were recently visiting Kosovo as part of the U.S. delegation. Would love to hear a description of what you guys were doing there and what the challenges were.
Oh, yes. That was back in 2020. So there was COVID, but there's also other things. And this is a water energy nexus story, really, where at the time there has been a Washington agreement between Kosovo and Serbia, and they agreed to coordinate. And one of those coordinations was on the coordination of a lake. And that lake is the Lake Gazivo Dužmani, which is a 15-mile long reservoir that crosses the border between Serbia and Kosovo, was built in the 60s, but it was managed without transboundary cooperation agreements. This is where the US DOE Office of International Affairs came to PNNL because we had this expertise. They asked us specifically, hey, can you evaluate the opportunities for managing this lake and then provide some recommendations? I got the opportunity to join the US delegation. Go there. That was the true football lifetime where you got to visit the reservoirs, the power plants, meet to all of those different users. Let me talk a bit more about what was happening here. It's like, what is the water energy nexus? This reservoir here is really managing water coming from different country. The hydropower coming from this reservoir, it isn't much. It's only 2% of the electricity generation and so the Kosovo electricity demand. What's happened is the release of those reservoirs. Out of those reservoirs, you had about 30% that goes into a canal, and that canal goes south for 100 of miles and feeds major cities from Kosovo, and most importantly, two thermal electric plants. And those two electric plants provide 95% of the generation of Kosovo and electricity demand. Just from this dam, 97% of the Kosovo electricity demand is met. So our role was to look for recommendations, and we met and we evaluated. I think that it really helped to be versatile in both water and electricity to really value the river services provided by the reservoirs, because it's providing cooling, but also all of the water supply and irrigation to the population. And at the same time, what is its contribution to electricity and transition of electricity potentially in the regions? At the end of the day, we provided recommendations. We thought we would go with a new optimization and so on. And then you go back to reality. It says, you know what, the canals, you need to make sure there is no losses. You build resilience on your water systems. You had another reservoirs to make sure that whatever happens to the canals, you have always reserves, provided some recommendations on how to make sure more the predictability of the inflow into the reservoirs. And of course, the most important was a river commission. And at the end of the day, you can have the engineering tools you want, but beside the optimization, you have the people making the decisions, and those are the trade-offs. And so that river commission was super important. I think what the reports provided that is not necessarily obvious is providing ways to evaluate the river services and electricity services for this river commission, which was super important.
That sounds like a lot of fun going over there and seeing all this in action and everything. And the reality is we can have all these sophisticated models and everything, but you get down to who's making the decisions and logic and some more fundamental analysis, I guess, rules the day. But sounds like it was a nice opportunity. You work on a lot of hydropower. Much of the electricity that you focus on is hydropower, which is strongly linked to water, of course. You know, I was working on the Colorado River base for a couple of years, looking at the data and everything. And I know it's been subjected to long-term drought, mega drought people talk about since 2000. And currently, Lake Powell is at 25% of capacity. And Lake Mead is at about third capacity, 33%. They're always talking about the water levels fall below the critical level and they won't be able to generate hydropower. The thing that perplexed me is when I looked at how much electricity those reservoirs were generating, it seemed very small relative to the other sources of electricity in the region. Maybe you can explain why it's so important for the reservoirs, the hydropower.
Yeah, and some of the things that I read too is it's not because one reservoir goes down below the intake to the penstock that the grid is going to go black. There are two misconceptions, like one, does hydropower matter? Yes, it does, but don't worry, the grid is still going to function without it. Yet still, it's super important. I think it goes back to one of the books that I think a lot of water resource managers have read. It's Cadillac Deserts by Mark Reisner. And it really explains about the role of those man-made reservoirs in the West, which were really financed to support settlements and provide not only hydropower, but most important was to provide a number of river services, which was flood control and water supply, in particular for irrigation. We're going to call them river services or hydropower services. Those are actually the major objectives of those dams. And hydropower is a byproduct. But that byproduct is very important because the electricity it provides, the first priority is to support the conveyance of this irrigation at a preferred price. The irrigation and the water supply is actually linked to the hydropower that is generated by those dams at a preferred price. And secondly, the dams are subsidizing a number of river services, flood control, recreation, tourism, which is a $1 billion enterprise. You want to keep the reservoir high. And all of this, the maintenance of the reservoir is actually maintained by the revenue from hydropower. So it's all an entire enterprise, and that's why hydropower is important for a number of applications for the local economies.
Right. The electricity they generate and the money that they get from that then supports the reservoir operations and the maintenance of the reservoirs and all of those things. It's a Bureau of Reclamation reservoirs, right?
That is correct.
Yeah.
And that would be the same for also a privately owned reservoirs, like they're self-sustained.
Yeah, we oftentimes talk about the water intensity of electricity production. For hydropower, then I see that oftentimes people assign all of the evaporation from the reservoir to the hydropower generation, whereas we use those reservoirs for a lot of different objectives, recreation and transport maybe and other things. But do you really think it's fair to assign all of the evaporation of the reservoir to the hydropower and then say its water intensity is off the scale?
This is one of the sensitive ones, and this is where I think the hydropower industry is bringing this up, is that the hydropower is subsidizing a number of those services. It is the case with evaporation. It's actually also the case with lakes that have greenhouse gas emissions. It is not associated with hydropower. It should not be fully allocated to hydropower because it has to do with all of the other services it provides, which is, again, recreation and flood control. Flood control in particular requires to have very large fluctuations in the reservoir level. No, I agree.
A lot of reservoirs have a function of supplying water for irrigation, so I think it's a bit unfair.
It's a bit unfair, but I don't think we have come across with one consensus on how to make this allocation.
Right. I was reading Kevin Fedarko's book on the Emerald Mile about the Colorado River, and it was really fascinating. Very high precipitation, snow and precip in 1983. He describes how they almost lost the Glen Canyon Dam. The way he describes it is that it started with a very small structural deficit during construction, and then that expanded and expanded, and there were concerns that they might lose the dam with those high flows. The reservoir fleet is pretty old. I mean, we built most of our reservoirs in the 60s, 70s, right? And so reservoir upkeep. I also remember Oroville Dam with the atmospheric rivers from 2017, which flows, and then all the people that were evacuated and everything in case that had a problem. We had the bipartisan infrastructure law providing funding for infrastructure, dam upkeep and things like that. Was that part of the programs or is that funded?
I will deflect a little bit your questions on whether the infrastructure is upkeep. I would say that the overall infrastructure on the energy, on the river systems, but also the entire grid has been built decades ago and requires to be retrofitted, renewed, updated. And one of the challenges for hydropower that is different from other plants like wind and solar and thermoelectric plants, those plants live what we call their plant life is about 20 to 30 years. Hydropower, it's 100 years. It means that right now, when we are looking into features for those dams, should they have a higher, a bigger storage, a bigger capacity, or what will be the combinations of turbines because there is more variability in the water? Should they be the same size? Should they be at the same height? What are the ways that you can get there? And there is a little bit of a disconnect by technology on what are the projections. We've been moving forward with the Secure Water Act. Lately, we released the third Secure Water Act, which is led by Oak Ridge, and hydropower was contributing on the hydropower specific piece, figuring out those are long-term projections because the infrastructure is there for 100 years. It provides really great input on what to expect in overall generation. But another source of uncertainty is going to be how people want to use hydropower. Hydropower is not just used for generation. I think this is what may be one of the misconceptions. Hydropower is also used for incorporate the grid. It's not just generating. You also need to be flexible. You need to do some ramping. You need to make sure you are at 60 hertz. And you need to have black start, like when everything goes down, how you bring it up. So there is a list of actually 50 types of services. And some of them might require different types of turbines. Long-term planning for that infrastructure for hydropower is really challenging because it's not just the change on the grid, it's also the change on what will be the electricity demand, what will be the different markets, what are the other technologies that hydropower is going to support, and what are the different water uses, what are different institutions. It's enough right for a lot of researchers to work on it.
Well, it's hard to manage many masters. So if there's a lot of functions that they might serve, then it might be difficult to optimize and figure out what to do. You've been working in this space most of your career, right, at the interface between water and energy. And that involves working with different communities. I mean, the water community and the electricity energy community. And terminology varies and projection periods also vary. Can you describe a little bit, you know, how that has evolved in, through your career and how you got to understand how all of these different actors play together or trying to bring them together, I would guess, you know?
Yeah, my background is in water resources engineering. So I was pretty set on how it works on the water side. You get to understand the engineering, but also what's important is the institutions. What is long-term planning? What it means for water? What is medium-term and short-term planning? What are the drivers of planning? Who are the players for each horizons of the decisions? And when I joined PNNL a couple years ago, I was working on developing forecasts for hydropower reservoirs. And then I was looking into proposals, going to more forecasts and so on. I was challenged on really saying, yeah, but why is it important for energy systems? So I got to learn on the field And it was just really an opportunity. And I had great colleagues who helped me understand and guided me. I learned by analogy, where understanding that hydropower is part of the river system, which is how I was told, but discovering that hydropower was part of a network on the grid, where you also manage different resources, you also manage different institutions. I'm still learning. Also because the institutions change. That's really how I learn, through colleagues, through great teams. And yeah, I lost my thought on that.
It's okay. Working at that interface, it took me a while to figure out, because I'm so dense, the differences between water and electricity, and the fact that you can store water in reservoirs or in the subsurface or whatever, but it's difficult to transport water because it's heavy. But on the other hand, electricity, you can readily transport it with transmission grid, but storing it is very challenging. You work a lot on the Western Energy Coordinating Council, or the WECC. Can you describe how that helps manage the demand and supply? You mentioned earlier, demand needs to meet supply, 60 hertz, and the buffer is very small at microsecond level. When I went to ERCOT and I saw that big thing, 60 hertz, 50, whatever, it's pretty scary.
Yeah, I think I mentioned the way I see the grid as part of this network is virtual water transfer. So exactly what you say. And I think I mentioned earlier, hydropower provide a number of services. One of these services is storage, long-term storage. And in a way that is also likely the most efficient long-term storage, because there is no loss on efficiency, no loss in the transformations. It's the same as operations or storage, it will have the same efficiency.
Just to make sure to resolve any disconnects between supply and demand, load and whatever you call it.
And the way that we work water is really represented into those 2Ds. There are multiple steps into understanding the long-term planning. There is resource adequacy, and then there is reliability. In the resource adequacy, those are short and representative periods. It's really going to be a bit about capacity. So with hydropower, it's going to be understanding the operational capacity at strategic times. When it comes to reliability, this is where storage is going to be very important as well. It took years. I think I started in 2015, I started attending the meeting with the WECC and working with the teams, really understanding a bit more about the power systems and how they were considering hydropower. And hydropower is one part of all of the other technologies that they have. When I first came, I was like, yeah, we're going to do coupling between power system models and the water management models, going to be optimization and so on. And I was like, no, because they have so many questions. Representing water is computationally too expensive. Depending on the region, it took a number of years to really understand and build trust and understand what would be the level of representation with computational and fidelity and so on, that they would be okay experimenting with. We came up with data sets. And at the time, they were only using observations and they were bringing data from different regions. We've been working and honestly, I've been growing with them on developing this business case, on first demonstrating that a normal year, a median year, it's very difficult to find. It's actually always wet somewhere and dry somewhere else. That was important for their reliability studies, because if they were bringing different water years to be average everywhere, what would happen is that, sure, from the generation side on hydropower, it would be median, but what they would lose is the expectation in cross-regional transfer, like the virtual water transfer. On this one, it means that their science questions about reliability of the grid through transmission is not robust. Things have evolved, and then we made the case on how you have 20 years of drought, how to make consensus on selection of what is a representative drought. And this is really what is motivating a lot of my work with my team right now, is development of data sets that provide this interannual variability. Also the selection, the guidance on selecting events that are going to be relevant for, do you want to test how much storage you need in a specific region? Or do you want to evaluate what are going to be the transmission needs between virtual water transfer needs through transmissions between regions? And so it's very rich.
Yeah, it gets quite complicated, doesn't it? Looking at the WEC, I was just seeing that California, the net imports account for 20 to 30% of their electricity. So it's all across the Western US. I'm not sure how many states.
11.
11 parts of other states, maybe too.
Yeah. Even.
Having that giant interconnection then means that it increases your reliability, right? That you can bring power from other regions. But also, people talk about the reserve margin. You have a capacity that exceeds your peak demand. I think most states try to aim for maybe something around 15% reserve margin. These are ways to make sure that you can tolerate different stresses.
And what's happening, maybe I can provide some background on this, is if we're on the water side, we're very familiar with the watersheds and all the precipitation that define the watersheds. Every precipitation from here is going to go at the outlet in one location. What's happened with the grid is that they have what we call balancing authorities. In many other regions across the world, it will be one country. The balancing is because the US are so big. And within this balancing authority, the local load has to be met by the local generation in priority before relying on transmission. And that's pretty important because as you bring more wind and solar and technologies that varies and are very intermittent, it's very difficult to use the transmission. The transmission is a big machine and you can't go back and forth. You have to schedule. I'm simplifying, but you have some to schedule certain directions. Within this balancing authority, it means that depending on the generation portfolio, you're going to have a need for specific reserve depending on the generation portfolio. That reserve depends and it's very regional. In places where you have a lot of wind and solar, typically you will have a higher reserve. In places where, like you mentioned, if you rely a lot on transmission, not necessarily you have a lot of renewable, but there are a number of combinations like this you can play with. Actually, over the Northwest, the reserve is much lower. It's in Texas, I believe, that one of the reserves is the highest.
With the deregulation, I'm not sure that ERCOT aims for 14, 15%. But I was just looking, so do you have a much different electricity portfolio in, say, for example, Washington State? You've got 60% hydro, 20% nuclear, is it, or something like that? And than thermoelectric. To beat ERCOT in Texas, we're a lone ranger. ERCOT is on its own. We have very few interconnects. I just wonder, the Western interconnection and the Eastern interconnection, a huge number of states, and maybe that helps with reliability.
Absolutely. The footprint here, and I think I was mentioning it earlier, is when we select those droughts, it's a way to say how the spatial variability has really providing a lot of this reliability. I was talking earlier on how you don't have a median year. It's always wet somewhere and dry somewhere. And that provides some of the early research I had, which was demonstrating the transmissions between the Pacific Northwest and California. And we could demonstrate that there was interconnect transfer was actually linked with those wet and dry status. Very recently, we updated that study showing the opportunities to provide climate information on how you could predict stress on the reliability, where those transmission might not be enough. So we evaluated El Niño and La Niña, where during a La Niña, typically it's wet in the Northwest and dry in California. And then El Niño is the reverse. Typically you hear in the region, oh, we have a La Niña and El Niño, it's going to impact our region. Their region, that is very true. It means that there will be, for example, less water over the Northwest. It doesn't mean that there will be issues with the reliability. It's just going to be more expensive because there will be less hydropower. But when it comes, it just means the electricity will come from somewhere else. Actually, what we were showing is that it's during the neutral El Niño, when everything is dry everywhere, it was a challenge for the grid. That was the grid from 2010 at the time. This is when you had the most stress because you could not rely on that regional variability to provide reliability.
Right. Yeah. We're always hearing about El Niño and La Niña. It's interesting then that it was the ENSO neutral years that were really challenging because every place was dry. The interconnected couldn't really help. We're used to talking about floods and droughts in terms of meteorology and hydrology, but some of your work also talks about renewable droughts with solar and wind. And maybe you can describe those a little bit.
Yeah, my research is very important. And we've moved forward with describing and characterizing droughts and their impact on hydropower and thermoelectric plants at the same time. I think I've mentioned that the grid manages multiple resources. Going into water and thermoelectric plants at the same time was really important to show that vulnerability of the grid to water. But the power grid infrastructure has changed tremendously since 2010, where there's much, much more wind and solar. So it was time to also ask, what about those compound energy droughts in wind and solar? And in particular, I always come back to water, but the contribution of water, of hydropower, has changed from generations to ramping to accommodate those plants because it provides storage as well. It was good to understand and characterize what we call those energy droughts, with the end goal to understand what was the value of storage. It was pretty interesting because for energy droughts, we use the concept of the balancing authority. That's the right scale because of the implication on the decision making, and really highlighting how this work is done. Cameron Bracken is on my team and has been really leading this work and doing great work, really showing how the energy droughts don't necessarily have the same duration across the US. So again, understanding also the coincidence between those energy droughts across balancing authority, and then understand what would be the need for transmissions. It's not just what is the future of climate. Are there people asking us, are energy droughts going to be more intense moving forward? And same thing with hydropower. The difference with wind and solar is that the infrastructure is changing exponentially every year. What we're finding is that, yes, those energy droughts are going to be more intense because they're going to be more wind and solar. So it's really opening the question here on how to design where you put wind and solar, not because this is where there's a lot of wind and solar, but in a way to reduce the intensity of those energy droughts. There might be places where it's not as lucrative if you see one plant at a time, but if you look at it from a system perspective, it's going to provide that diversity that is going to provide services, or at least less work to the grid and to other technology to complement.
Right. Yeah. That sounds very interesting, because normally when I think of wind and solar, it just seems like to me, well, did they get permission from the landowners? Can they get access to the land and all of these other things? But what you're saying is that you really need to be strategic in where you place them in order to manage the grid. That's another level of management. I really liked your paper on water security, where you describe different options for making a system more reliable. You describe the different factors that contribute to reliability and how you could do that at the plant scale, at the grid scale. Maybe you can describe that a little bit, Natalie.
Yeah, actually, there's a story behind this work where Fred Bowles at the time was developing a special issue on water security. His theme was that water is the master variable, solving for every type of resilience. And so he reached out and he was like, so Nelly, water is a master variable for the power grid. I was like, well, you're preaching to the choir, but I think a lot of people are going to disagree. Let's evaluate what that is. That's what this paper on water security is. And you're correct. We reviewed at different scales. So you have individual power plants, and then you have at a regional scale, which could be watershed or urban scale, the scale of the water management, and then the scale of the entire grid. What are the connections with water? How do they respond to water stress? What are the tipping points for each of those scales where they might decide to disconnect from water or not? Then it gets more complex. We're going through a review where at an individual plant, you're going to reoperate. There, yes, there's going to be less generation, but you're going to maintain the different services and so on. Eventually, and this is something that we started seeing, when a plant, one single hydropower plant, is not producing as much as expected, and the overall river services are not worth it as deemed by a commission, then it will be removed. We've seen some of those instances, the Helwa River, for example, was of the first one with these big discussions. For the thermoelectric plants, there is one of the tipping points is going to be switching from what we call wet cooling to dry cooling. This is a big decision. Wet cooling, it's like a run through, is very efficient and cheap. As you switch to dry cooling, it's going to be a whole discussion on the overall efficiency, and you might actually need a new plant. I mean, I can go then on watershed scales. It's going to be a redistribution of resources. At the grid scale, it's going to be more management. Maybe something that is important to me that I want to mention is that quantifying and bringing forward the sensitivity of the power grid operation on all of the energy sectors to water is the energy sector has a lot on their plate. The major driver is load, electricity demand, and eventually technology innovation. With all the science and the knowledge we have about climate, the Earth system community has been saying, what are the opportunities to really inform more of this long-term planning and operations with this knowledge? As we all need to do in the business of science, we need to get a business case and we have to say what it matters. And so we had to go with the worst case scenario. And with these worst case scenarios, we call it water threat and so on. The energy sector might see it as, if this is a threat, we're going to disconnect. When I think that what the Earth system science is saying is like, here are the opportunity to do joint management. And I'm just bringing this up because there's a lot of opportunities to bring a lot of the Earth system science and forecasting, trying to ponder some of the language here. I don't think for a number of all of the social economic studies are showing that when you use the resources smartly, using the knowledge on how to use them, it's going to be more beneficial than disconnecting and going to those massive changes.
Right. Texas experienced probably one of the worst drought years on record in 2011. And I was wondering why we didn't have any blackouts or things like that. So I looked at, reservoir levels once through cooling. Sometimes they had cooling towers. It was amazing how many different things they could turn to survive. A pipeline had been completed the year before that brought water. And each case that we looked at, individual plant level, it seemed like that they had multiple backups. And what you describe for thermoelectric, maybe they could just go disconnect. But as you say, then having water cooling makes it less energy intensive. It's more energy efficient. And so you use less energy and you have less greenhouse gas emissions and other things. Going to dry cooling, you need more land, and then it's not as effective. So there's an energy penalty. A lot of times, I guess, with these discussions and then optimizing, it's looking at trying to manage the trade-offs. At the grid scale, in that paper, you mentioned reserve margin and increasing that maybe, or transmission planning. But a lot of these things will be costly and increase your cost of electricity. So how much insurance do you want to buy? What type of drought do you want to prepare for? But it's interesting to hear that you're not just relying on the observational record, because that's just one set of data. And as you say, one place might be dry and the other place wet. So how do you develop these synthetic scenarios then to evaluate the reliability of the grid?
Yes, a lot of the adequacy effort is based on probabilistic metrics, like the lot of load probability. With wind and solar and temperature, there are some synthetic weather generator, and you can go ahead based on historical weather and you have a certain set of infrastructure and you develop those, and you will have a lot of ensembles because those are short term. When it comes to water, it's a little bit more complex because it's difficult to get the probabilities using 40 years and get those probabilities and then get a synthetic generator. Your initial observation is just not long enough. It is one of the challenges that actually is the start of the new initiative, where I think that so far when we've been doing the long-term planning, we were looking at using climate change projections and going to go to 2100. The uncertainty was really based on trends. It's been a long time that the community has said we need to pay attention to the extreme events, hence some of the probabilities. And what we're doing here, it's a team of 40 staff contributing to it. One of the activities is actually working on probabilities of extremes in the near term. That's also something we learn, is that we want to support the long-term electricity planning, except for hydropower for the design. If at the grid scale, it's the next 10 years and 20 years. So all of the probabilities should be about the extremes around that horizon.
Right. And so a lot of people might be listening to this podcast with just audio, Natalie. So what you were referring to is foresight.
Thank you.
Right. And that acronym is Framework for Optimizing Reliable Energy Systems and Infrastructure Given High Uncertainty Trajectories. It's a bit of a mouthful. So another aspect, that trying to get those extremes, you need a large ensembles in order to capture the extremes. Yes. We have the same in hydrology with droughts and floods. We cannot just rely on observations. But another aspect of your work that I really like is these Sankey diagrams. I don't like them just because Sankey was an Irish guy, but I like how it explains from the energy source to the uses and the applications and the waste heat. It's a bit a budget type of thing. Maybe you can describe those, and you have them for the WECC and the Eastern Interconnection and ERCOT and these different regions. And how do you guys use, I mean, they're pretty difficult to compile, right? It's a lot of information.
Yeah, those were compiled by my colleagues, Kendall Monger, Jenny Rice, Costas Oikonomou, and Juliet Homer. It's in Utilities Policy 2023, and they are updating those Sankey diagram. It took them a lot of work to provide them Sankey diagram or those flows where you have all of the, it's not just electricity, it's all of the energy sources and all of the different water use, and then it shows the interconnection. They've been very successful on particularly identifying for different states and different power grid. They are very critical for understanding the water energy nexus, that this is regional, that the solutions that you may have for when we were saying, for example, disconnecting from water, when you look at those Sankey diagram, you can see that over the Western US, we have a lot of hydropower. For all of the other technology, it's already very disconnected from the water sector. And over the Eastern US, where you have plentiful of water, actually the energy sectors was designed around this plentiful water. So it's important to make recommendations that are going to be around those Sankey diagram, or I think they also have them as a time series to see on how it has evolved across the years.
Oh,
and that really allows to provide some lesson learned on how the infrastructure has changed. When I say it's been designed around water, that's, there are places where you can see that.
And you can really see the uses then, you know, it talks about transportation and irrigation and all sorts of things. With the evolution of the grid, you see increasing electrification, more EVs, more load in the future, and then trying to meet that load. That's a big, big issue for power grid.
Projecting what the load is going to be is likely the elephant in the room, depending on, you know, the changes in policy. And currently, the data centers are also one of the big challenges. With respect to what we have talked about, it's important to understand the implication where you have the increase in load. With this increase in load, there is the questions of where they go and who needs to build the capacity and the power plant to follow this load. In the question of where, you know, there's the concept of balancing authority. Will the data centers balance their own load? Because it will be very intermittent as well. There are different types of investors. There are places where you're planning to rely on transmissions and buy from the market. There are places where it's a publicly or privately owned utilities. And so the way to invest into those extra power plants is going to be a very different financial mechanism. So this is where a lot of the challenge is, following the load and then how to make it happen? How do you evaluate? I think you were mentioning before, is there going to be enough land, or, you know, what will be the impact on power grid, not just from a reliability, but also from a financial perspective?
Right. And getting back to your water security paper, I mean, there's a lot of discussion these days about the water demands for the data centers. And I know you're not you have a separate team working on data centers, so I won't probe too much. But I think in that water security paper, you can say they could disconnect. And some people say, well, they will use single cycle gas without water for cooling or whatever. So they could disconnect, but then there's the energy penalty and loss in efficiency and everything. So there are different ways of managing things. And I guess it's early days. And so there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of discussion. But yeah, challenging times. But the other aspect that I wanted to mention, I really appreciate all the data sets that you guys are developing. And I really like the hydropower data set that you developed with Sean Turner at Oak Ridge National Lab. Maybe you can describe that a little bit.
Yeah, well, actually, those were developed when he was at PNNL.
Oh, okay.
And that has to do with, I think, the work that I was mentioning earlier, where we had made the landscape already for what the power system modelers were willing to take into their power systems, and also what was the data availability. So at the time, I had a project to develop that first set of multi-year hydropower data sets that was based on simulations like monthly hydropower. That's the place where we had the representation of the water management was good enough that we could go to monthly. And then we had planned to use observed stream flow to go from monthly to weekly. And we were moving forward. So Sean was implementing it. And then he came one day and said, those monthly data, observed data, they don't make any sense. And he went on and he tracked where the problem was. So we found that, you know, a lot of the EIA monthly data were actually imputed. And so what we had planned to do on the simulations, we ended up doing it on the observations to go from monthly to weekly. And then PNNL now is continuing working on this, going from monthly to weekly. And we have a range of data sets at the weekly timescale. And we're really paying attention to have always enough power plants that it can go into power grid. Like we're really working on getting those power systems relevant data sets, multi-years. So there's the part that is on observation that we keep updating, bringing more and more data as they come in. We also have a data set where we call it Go Deep Hydro. That was the name of the project I was leading. The point is that we have 40 years of historical data based on simulation, but it's historical. And then the particularity of the future period is that it's the same sequencing. So it allows us to say what was a drought in 2001, which was a drought out record. How would it be in the future? How more intense it would be? And this is when you talk about the stakeholders, they're not necessarily yet going into projection. But this framing is very important because they can relate on what happened then and what it would be in the future. And then we have other data sets, weekly data sets. They are available for the entire CONUS at this time based on the Secure Water Act. So we're developing them, and then we'll have more if we continue going.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, it's great. The data sets and the modeling are continually improving so we can better understand. But the challenges are also increasing, it seems like, with the different portfolio of energy, electricity systems. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Natalie. Our guest today was Natalie Voisin, and she is the Chief Scientist for Regional Climate Energy Dynamics at Pacific Northwest National Lab. So good luck with your work, and really appreciate what you do.
Thank you so much, and thanks for the opportunity to share what we do on that water energy nexus. I hope people enjoyed it.